Today, we want to take up the story of only four verses in chapter 6 of the sons of the gods and the giants, which is a very surprising sort of story. The reason why it's surprising is because you have a very offensive story. You have love-smitten divine males seizing and raping beautiful human females and siring a super race of giants. Now, Israel's pagan neighbors, the Canaanites, they told similar stories about gods producing more than human demigods, offspring, kind of half-human and half-divine. Some of you may know specifically from Greek mythology, they told how the demigod, the Titan Prometheus, the friend of the human race, led a great rebellion against the regular gods, the 12 Olympian gods, one that proved unsuccessful. They couldn't quite do it because the one Olympian god of the sea, Poseidon, had earthquakes and knocked them down, even though they took us on Pelion and tried to get up there. But Zeus had his thunderbolts and they went, and there were giants coming up there. And if you want to know what the giants, the Nephilim, are in this Hebrew section, the way they pictured it, don't go to our modern graphic artists. I like our graphic artists. The kids, the high schoolers and college kids like to read all this stuff. And maybe you know from the cartoons that you see around what they make of them. But you have to go to the way they would picture it. For instance, in Berlin, used to be East Berlin, in the famous Pergamon Museum, they have the altar of Zeus, where the Greeks, civilized people, have to fight against the barbarian people who are wicked and uncivilized with the help of the giants. And there you will see those giants are pictured the way they thought of them, as kind of snaky haired, and their thighs and their ends go into snakes, and they're monstrous. And such myths, I think we concede, they have a native home and make some sense if they're in pagan culture, a kind of masterpieces the way they had in a polytheistic culture like the Greeks or the Canaanites. They had all these gods and goddesses and they fought with one another and they had such stories, such myths. But to have our Bible, the monotheistic Bible says that you can have only one reality, and that's the Lord, why should our Bible refer to such monstrous goings-on? And so this is a very offensive sort of story. And I'm just saying that at the beginning so that you kind of get to know what we're getting into. And then we'll gradually come back to and read it. We won't start with that today, with the reading of the scripture, but I'd like to give some background. I'm kind of glad, ladies and gentlemen, that we have a day off and only have four verses to go over, because so often we've been so busy getting each individual story that we haven't had a chance to look at. But to answer my question, the reason why our Bible includes this is that this is the way the ancient people could refer to the most monstrous imaginable violation of human limitations, that humans want to become more than human. They want to become what? Superhuman. And that's what the ancient people knew of, and so why shouldn't it be referred to? So I call this the sons of the gods and the giants. Do you notice where we are right here? We have had a bunch of stories, and we'll still have tomorrow the flood, and then the day after, Thursday, Noah and his sons, and the day after that, the Tower of Babel. So we're kind of coming toward the end of this. But today, all we have here is the sons of the gods and the giants, the human race's attempt to become a super race. Now, I'd like to just review, and I think most of you, Elmina, I think, and you, Grace, have been here, but just what have we been looking at? We've been looking at what I consider The Bible's universal primer. A primer is a basic text. And if you, in the old days we used to do that, had a primer to learn English. If you could read everything in the primer, you could read everything in English, couldn't you? You knew everything. In German, we used to have a feeble. When I had to go to prep school and I didn't know German from my home, they sent me the whole summer before that to the pastor, and he had what they called in German a feeble. And so I learned to go to read German and to write German and all the basics. It still was pretty tough, even though he was a good teacher. But if you understood a primer, you understood the basics. And I consider what we have in Genesis 1 to 11 is the universal primer. Before you have the individual Abram, the forefather of the chosen people, you know, and then Moses and all the prophets and the rest that we have in the Old Testament, the Bible begins, first 11 chapters, with a history of humankind. It's very, very universal. The first story we have is the Creator's seven masterpieces. How in the midst of what was without form and void, and what is still way up above the firmament, where the waters are way up above the firmament, that blue that we see up there, and way down below in the deep, in the flood, they'll all come out, the windows of heaven will be open, and the waters will come down, and the fountains of the deep will come up, and there'll be nothing but trouble. Only one little ark with all of creation on that one ark floating in the midst of it. And the only reason that that doesn't happen now, ladies and gentlemen, is because God established seven masterpieces right here where we are. And we live in a wonderful world, which God has. And he said of each one of these masterpieces, after seven times he says, let there be, and there was. It says, and he saw how good it was. He was happy with his creation. And he wants us to be happy with his creation. Then we took, and we took two sessions on this, humans in God's garden, in the garden of joy. Eden means joy, Garden of Eden. There you have the creatures, the Creator's most puzzling creatures. They are on the one hand well endowed by the Creator, that you have in chapter 2. God gives them the breath of life. He gives them a garden, a home to live in. He gives them work, something meaningful to do for their life. He gives them free choice. They can either follow his command or disobey it. They're not puppets. He gives them fellow creatures, all kinds of non-human creatures, and he gives them human community. And at the end, the man says, this at last is what I've been waiting for. That is what the gifts that make us human. But at the same time, that same wonderful story tells how severely limited we are. By God's ordinances, we aren't going to be able to eat of the golden apples and the tree of life and live forever. We live not in the garden of joy, we live outside of it, you see that? And we're threatened by what? Death. And we live in the meanwhile with what? Sorrow and pain and weeds and thistles that grow faster than the crops we have, and we have to, in the sweat of our brow, eat our daily bread. And that's limited, and that's our life according to this primer. The next story we had was Cain and Abel, where we have two brothers, and they represent, like all these people, all humans. It isn't just one bad guy, the first murderer, and his victim, Abel. It's every human being who, when he does his honest labor as a tiller of the ground and brings a thank offering to God, is not accepted. He is unsuccessful. And his brother beats him out. And here you have a social relationship. This is very important. Too many people only read chapter 2 and 3. And religion today is with many people just being Jesus. But the Bible here at the beginning has humans in society. So you've got humans alongside other humans in society. They can be helper cooperators. They can, for instance, Cain does his work as a farmer, domesticates plants, and brings in the harvest. and Abel domesticates animals and brings sheep and goat. And don't we call that the division of labor? It's the foundation of all economics. And they can cooperate. But one can also be successful, and the other person can be unsuccessful, isn't it? And that's what causes the trouble in society. And people don't like that when one person gets succeeds and the other one doesn't. Especially if they say, God has respect to the gift of the one, but not to the gift of the other. And then they take things into their own hands and get angry, and they are competitors, and then finally you have murder. Well, we saw how God then put a mark on even the murderer Cain, and how God wants to solve that. Then our next story was a very interesting one, the first genealogy. And these next two stories are genealogies. The first one about humanity's cultural achievements from agriculture. Cain, first farmer. Enoch, the first city dweller. Jabal, the first person with animal husbandry, domesticated animals. Jubal, first musician, harp and lyre. Tubal-Cain, the first metallurgy. And, ladies and gentlemen, we'll have that next time. Noah, the first man who planted a vineyard and made wine to make our life a little nicer, if you want to be naughty, which I am right now. But those are cultural achievements. And even then, the last verse of that chapter, then began men to call on God. So the beginning of religion, which is quite surprising. Then a very difficult thing that I had last time was the genealogy. Adam lived 130 years and begat Seth, and after he begat Seth, some of you were here, many of you were here, and we talked about that. I guess, just to repeat the main idea, I called it the human family's family tree. And I should have stressed that more than I did yesterday. Humanity's mighty movement through time, long periods of time. And they knew they were long periods, and he lived a long, very long time, and even a longer time than a very long time. Generation after generation, even though each individual dies at the end, finally the stream of humanity continues to the very end. Well, now we come then to the story of the sons of the gods and the giants. And I guess what I'd like to, before we go in on to, just to that, I'd like to just, and we'll read it verse by verse here, I'd like to take up something that several of you have asked me about, and that is, what is the name that we can give to these stories? There are a number of them. Some people have said this is history. It's the first history in the world. When someone says this is history, I put three question marks. I think you could understand it's related to history. In fact, that tells you what really was going on in history all the time from the beginning. But to call these stories just history, either eyewitness or contemporary history, like Amani, you were mentioning the person that was interested in writing the history of Southern California churches, Lutheran churches. Well, he's got to have either documentation from the church books or writings or letters that have come from that time, eyewitness or contemporary or something like that, isn't it, for his records. And if he has oral history, okay, it might go back and it might not. But what you'd like to do is, I wrote a history of a congregation in Watertown, Wisconsin, 100th anniversary. And when I started, I thought there would be people who would have real experience of it, but they have about all long past dead and gone. You would have some of their letters and things like that, but nothing orally that you could talk to them to see that. And therefore, to call this is not something written by Adam or Noah or something like that, not even by Abraham. Now, therefore, some people will go on, and so I put question marks about that. Is this then remembered history? In other words, history as people remember it. The technical term for that is saga. I'll put two question marks after that. Because I think these stories are not just stories about, let's say, Cain, one individual people who weighed, like Ralph Gierke, 170, and lived at one particular time, but that these are stories that are typical of all people, Cain, or the humans here who want to become more than human, or let's say, we all know that of Adam and Eve. We are all Adam, aren't we? We're all Eve. And we all do the same sorts of things. So to nail these down and say, we'd like to know on a timeline of when it was, and we can't really know, we have only a vague memory of it, and to call this a saga. Some people use that term, even this very nice textbook. By the way, if you want a textbook on this whole course, this is the one, there are copies of it in the bookstore, by John Gibson. He's a Scotch Presbyterian, and he's taken over the revision of what is called the Daily Study Bible Series. Some of you maybe know that from Barclay. William Barclay used to do that. And people used to have that, and they really liked it. And the press, Westminster Press, has redone that. So if you'd like to have, it's very similar to what I'm presenting here, but he does it from his own angle, and that's good to learn. You never learn from one teacher. You also have to have two teachers.
It's in blue in the bookstore, so don't go looking for a white trimmed in red.
It's blue, yes, right. It's blue in the bookstore, correct. Uh-huh. I think there were four copies there the other day. Now, maybe there are not many. There were 10 to begin with, so... if you're interested in continuing to read on this and study it, you'll find it quite helpful. Well, in other words, to call it a saga, I just say to myself, even that is not going to help us too much to understand them. There are other people who would say a little variant of that. If this is number one way to do it, and this is number two way to do it, they would say it's remembered history about holy person whom you're to imitate. And that we usually call a legend. And you can see I'm putting double question marks after that too. You perhaps know the legends that they have about saints. Let's take, for instance, the Roman Catholic monastery. If they're going to have St. Francis Day on October 4th, the night before, while the monks are reading and eating in silence, they will read this a legend, a stories about St. Francis. So the monks will be ready the next day when they have the great festival to know what they're doing. The Latin word legenda means what should be read for that saint's day. You see that? And so I'm taking these words, saga and legend, in a very precise manner. Again, I would not call these stories that we've been dealing with, these narratives, legends. I think legend is about a holy person whom we're to imitate. And some of these guys we have no business imitating. Certainly not the sons of the gods according to the daughters of men, the people who want to live forever and that sort of thing, or Cain or something like that. So we come to the third one, and this one you'll find quite popular, myth. It's usually put in quotation marks, at least that's what Gibson does, and I'll do that too. Simply because in our culture, when somebody says that's a myth, that then what does that usually mean?
Not true.
It's not true, see. In this case, a mythos in ancient Greek is a story, and Plato, the great philosopher, he'd have even his great dialogues, his first section is all logic, but at the end he always tells a story. And he calls that a mythos. And he says that his mythos is truer than his argumentations of logic at the beginning. That's Plato. That's true. You look at all, if you study Plato, and I had to do that. I had my PhD in classics from the University of Chicago, so I had to study all that stuff. And so I know that you can use that. I don't like to use it because most of the time with my students at PLU, and perhaps with you too, people still have this idea of mythos that it's not true. And when somebody's idea is not clear, they immediately misunderstand it, they don't get it straight. So what I like to use is this word,
I'll put a question mark after this Mephis here. You notice I put three here, two here, only one there. And I like to call this a master story. And Almina is telling me that she likes that master story. it's kind of the way, he doesn't use that term too often. On the TV popular thing by Joe Campbell on the masks of God and so forth, they usually call them myths, you see that? And sophisticated people can get that, but most of our people will not get it. So I prefer to simply say it's a master story, a story that tells us our story, you see that?
Because that's my problem, I'm not sophisticated. Yeah, I don't like myth.
Yeah, okay. All right, well then why not use master story? That'll help you, won't it?
Right.
Notice what I'm doing here, I'm putting master story right on. So I don't mind doing that. So if these are less appropriate, what are more appropriate? Now, I've had other people who simply say, what you should call this part of the Bible is the Bible's prehistory. Again, I don't mind that too much, because in the Bible, Israel's history really begins with Abram. He's the father of the whole clan. You remember he had been called from Abram and called from paganism to by the one true God, and he was the first monotheist, if you want to say it that way, and Moses. And so this is before Abram. So I would prefer to simply say, okay, but why don't you say pre-Abrahamitic? These are master stories that tell about the time before Abram. Then other people would say these are primeval stories. They tell us about the first times of life, primeval, the first age. I would like to, and I'm coining a word here, omnival. This tells a story of everyone at all times in the past, at all times in the present, and of all times in the future. So if you really want to know who humans are, even today, you go back to where? To Genesis. You want to really know what creation in our world is today, who tells us the master story about understanding the world in which we live? Genesis. And so it's omnival, it tells it about. It's not just a story of the first person way back when, but it's a story of all. I like that a little better, but best of all, and you've heard me say this already, I like to call these prototypical. And I've usually gotten farthest with my students by saying, these stories are typical of what happens to human beings' relationship to God and fellow creatures from the beginning now. And in order to keep those people awake at PLU, they're not sleeping, they're usually pretty good students, but you know how college students are, they stay up all night, and if you don't really get after them, you don't get it. I simply say these are stories about things that never happen just that way, but that always happen in everything that has happened, that is happening, and will happen. Do you see what I mean by prototypical? It's a different type of literature. Now that makes you think in different terms, but it may open your ears to hear things from these ancient stories that otherwise you would simply cast out. Now you mentioned to me the other day that when you first read Genesis 5, you just got through all those big gaps, and you just kind of disregarded them. That's what modern people will do when it doesn't fit their patterns. But I think if you say that this is prototypical, surely it's Israelites' view of it. It's the ancient world, it's Hebrew. but it's more than that. It's also typical of what happens today. You see, when it comes to Genesis, there are three ways of doing it. I'm just going to read something that I prepared for my students once. If you take all these stories, you can simply say, these narratives don't make any sense. The rationalists do that. They're fatally flawed by a supernatural description of the origin of our world.
And this is an outdated attempt to describe the origin and early history of our world. It's mistaken historically, it didn't happen that way, and it's mistaken scientifically. What we need, such people would say, are accounts that are scientifically and historically factual. And so they won't listen to anything of the stories of the Bible anymore, but they'll listen only to what paleontology and other modern disciplines would tell them about the origin, early history of the world. Then there are the opposite side. We call them the fundamentalists. And there's something good about them, because they at least want to hold on to what? Fundamentals, and they're believers. And they say that we have here Scripture's divinely inspired description of the origin and early history of the world. That is both scientifically and historically true. And some of them then continue, they don't all agree on this, that the world is not nearly as old as some scientists claim, that the biblical deluge, we'll talk about that next time, accounts for the major changes that had been experienced. In fact, this account tells us the real truth about the world in its earliest history. God created it, and He shaped its earliest history. Now, I find bugs in both camps, the rationalists and the fundamentalists. And I just want to point out that I think they have some questionable assumptions. Both look upon these stories, these narratives, as the story of the origin and early history of the world. Actually, I would suggest to you that they are more basic than that. They are telling us what is typical of the realities in our world. Under God, of course, like the rationalists, this does have God talk in it. From of old, from the beginning, they describe, I'm being very provocative here, what never happened just that way, and therefore something that you could never verify by historical or scientific research. But they do tell us, and that's why it is genuinely historical, what has always been happening in history to people in their relationship to God and creation, what does happen now, and what will happen as long as there are human beings. Secondly, both the fundamentalists, and they're on shaky ground here, and the scientists have only one measure of standard by saying something is true or not, and that is modern historical and modern history and modern science. But such approaches and such a standard will simply not let these stories say everything they want to say. And therefore, a good share of it goes down the drain. And it's either nonsense to them or they don't understand it. My suggestion to you, therefore, and to all who want to listen to me, is that careful readers will notice, first of all, that in antiquity, people told such master stories. They told stories about the creation of the world. We have them in Babylon, we have them in Egypt, we have them in many, many stories, the origin of human beings. They have stories about how, after a catastrophic flood, order was established. We'll have that next time. And so they also had stories about the first crimes of human beings. We call them proto-crimes, and the ensuing ordinances. They had all these types of stories. They also had genealogies, listings of their ancestors, and also of great inventions of humanities. So they had such stories. And I think we approach that this is an ancient book. Certainly, the Holy Spirit to me is like a force of gravity that is giving us everything we need to know here, coming through Israel, speaking in human language, undoubtedly that, and through humans, but it's nevertheless divinely inspired, and it gives us all we need to know. So I think if we understand that these stories are Israel's monotheistic versions of these old master stories, and then they will tell us not only about life way back then, as much as we need to know for our faith, and this is a book of faith, but also what we need to know about God and other creatures and ourselves now, today. And is it true? Well, you just have to listen and say, is this true with my experience? And then you'll find out whether it's true or not. So do you see what I'm doing here? I'm taking quite a different approach than what is usually. Usually you have either the rationalists or the what? The fundamentalists, and they fight with one another and usually don't get much farther. And good friends can start off studying these things and end being on different sides. At PLU they don't date each other anymore. Until they come to my class and they get back. I'm teasing. Oh, I know precisely what I'm saying because I know my students talk about, but in other words, do you see what I'm looking, my approach here to Genesis 1 to 11? I say we have three types of literature, of material. We have creation stories, creation of the whole universe, and the creation of humans, chapter 1 and 2. We have crime and punishment stories. You know, remember that famous Russian novelist had, Dostoevsky had a novel called Crime and Punishment? That's what they are. You've got a crime, they do something wrong, and they have the ensuing, I call it ordinance, the punishment of God.
I couldn't read that word.
Pardon?
I couldn't read that ensuing.
Ensuing, yes. Okay. Ensuing ordinance. I'm sorry about that. And I put that in red. You see that? So let's look at the stories that we've had so far that are about crime and punishment. Well, certainly the story about the Garden of Eden is that, isn't it? Crime and punishment and the ordinance of God. Cain and Abel is too. Cain can't be a farmer anymore. He's polluted the earth, and he has to dwell east of Eden. And the earth will not give its soil. And so at the same time, God puts a mark on him, protects him, takes care of him. Then you have what I put here. I wish I had an orange color here, but I just don't have an orange color available here. For genealogies. First the genealogy of chapter 4, and then the genealogy of chapter 5, we had that last time. And I just put them as a color code alongside of here so that you can see the story we're going to have now, I call a crime and punishment story. The story that we're going to have next time, tomorrow, on the flood, and that's the longest story in all these stories. Look how long it is. 6, 7, 8, and half a 9. Longest story ever. It's really a crime and punishment story, but it also has to do with creation, that after the flood, God establishes with his rainbow order. And if you look at it kind of that way, that's fine. Thursday, we're going to have the story of Noah's drunkenness. And he wakes from his wine and curses the son who has been disregarding him, and the rest of his sons, too, that talked about. And then the last time I didn't put that on here would be the Tower of Babel. And that's another crime and punishment story. So along those terms, I think we can begin to talk with one another and understand one another. But let me stop here for a minute before we start reading verse by verse. Any questions, comments, stink bombs, bouquets? Elmina, she stayed through two sessions. She's really a good student. She's taking notes all the time. And we're going to go back to Tacoma. And all the way down Chelan, all the way back to Tacoma. I'll hear lots of questions about oral tradition and all kinds of things. But that's the way to learn.
Well, I think for many of us, this is the first time we have studied Genesis without taking in the rest of the Bible, Hebrews, and that to reflect back on it. So to me, it's a different way of approach.
Sure. Okay.
And when you bring the Holy Spirit in there, then I'm all right. Mm-hmm. But sometimes I get way off track when we talk about myths and all this prehistory. Sure, sure. And that's why I'm sitting through it twice.
Sure. Okay, good for you. We'll give her a star, a medal.
Because I am a, What are they calling it? Traditionalist?
Sure, sure. Well, we all grew up in tradition. In fact, the only reason why I guess I'm this interested is I grew up in a very strict tradition. But I guess somehow or other God has been good to me. First I studied, as I said, classics. So mm-hmm. I studied this at the horse's mouth, and I think you have to do that. You have to study the myths the way that ancient people told them. You see that? And you can't just... If any of you will be here tomorrow, I'm going to give a slideshow tomorrow evening, Wednesday evening, on my trip to Syria. And we have a lot of pictures of the Canaanites, the way the Canaanites looked at their god Baal, and the way they pictured it, the stories they told about it, and the way they pictured the Leviathan and so forth. And you really have to start. So, in a sense, I've been very happy personally to be able to affirm mm-hmm. all the realities of a traditional faith. At the same time, I'm not just a traditionalist, you see that?
Yeah.
That want to repeat the same things. I don't have the same opinions that my grandfather had. And I'm not married, never have been married, but if I had a grandson, I wouldn't expect him to have all the opinions. Right. I would hope that I would have the same faith that my grandfather had and that my grandson mm-hmm. would have that same faith. Although that I can't say either. People have to make choices here, you see that? All I'm doing is what... Since I was asked to be the Pope here and to be the leader, that I do the best I can in saying this is, I think, a better approach than others. But all along the way, people have to make choices, you see that. How about, is this all as clear as crystal or as clear as mud?
I have a question about, it seems like the scientific theory now seems to be that it was a big bang and the earth was created. But when you really stop to, when I stop to think about it, I don't know how it could be through anything like that to be created that way. Now, how does that fit in? I believe in the creation as a I don't see how they, but they're trying to convince people, and the schools are having problems. Because many of them, of course, the school boards don't accept it, and that there's competition, and I don't know how it fits together.
All right, very good. I guess I'm really in the same spot that you are. Mm-hmm. That on the one hand, I try to understand the Bible on its own terms. Do you see that? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I can say yes to that. There's no question. I'm not deceiving you. And when I say in church that I believe God is the creator of heaven and earth and he's my creator and is still creating, I believe that. At the same time, and though I'm not an expert in science, I just read Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time. Read it twice this summer, tried to understand it. And it's a little beyond some of my scientific understandings. I went to school in science 50 years ago, you see that. Although I keep on reading. And if they have a different pattern, I would let that stand, you see that. I guess what I'm saying is that we are not here in these early chapters having that sort of scientific and historical telling about the first events and the first humans that I could put it on a timeline and put Adam and Moses or Cain and all these people on a timeline. When I get to later to Moses, and certainly to Jesus, he was a human being, you see that, in the first century, that's easier. But you see, way back here, I can't really call this historical in that sense that I can make a correspondence to everything that's said here in the Bible to events that happen just that way. I can't really do that. It's, in that sense, remembered history. So I went through with this to get the idea with the various possibilities, and my best possibilities is simply call it a prototypical master story. And that it's therefore true because it illuminates life. And if someone says, this is Bosh, it doesn't illuminate life, then I'd ask, well, what do you think illuminates life? Some people would say the Buddhist opportunity, that life is so bad that if you even try to get involved in it, you're going to get into trouble. So you better stay out of it right from the beginning. You see that?
Yes.
Those, and that's an option for today. And it's an option in world religions, you see that? And mm-hmm. we can talk about that. Or there are other options, do you see that? I suppose basically all of us, this is my opinion, we're all by nature religious, no matter what culture we came originally. And then whatever culture we grow up in shapes us. Chances are that if I had been born in the Middle East, I'd be a Muslim. You see that? What God is going to do on Judgment Day, He's not going to ask you, were you a card-carrying Lutheran? Oh, I happen to be one. But Matthew 25, what's He going to ask you? What did you do for the hungry, the poor, and all the rest? What did you do with your life, isn't it? And so to say it provocatively, as a Christian, maybe on Judgment Day, and Jesus is the one who's going to be the judge, isn't it? The Savior is going to be the judge. Some of the people who we can't imagine now as being part of the kingdom will be. And Jesus says that, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And so I think that well-meaning and honest atheists might be there. I'd be surprised. It could be that at that time Jews would recognize Jesus really is the Messiah. Do you see that? Sure. But we'll have to leave that up to the future. Am I answering your question a bit, or your concern?
Yes, it
sure. I don't like the idea that some people would say you've got to be kind of what they call, you can't be an evolutionist, that God didn't work that way. You've got to be a creationist. You see that? And some of them even would say it had to be in 4004. Most of them are off of that. Then they go to the Greek translation and they add about 10,000 years more, but that doesn't help too much. When you get to the Big Bang, and that, again, is only a theory. If you read Stephen Hawking's, the people, SETI stream people, aren't sure. But it's the best we have right now, you see that. And, but I would never trust that to go to the scaffold for scientific theory. I wouldn't even go to the scaffold for so many of the things I teach here.
Well, in 1937, that was the year I graduated from high school, the big thing was Darwin's theory. And any Lutheran that was going on to college, especially a public college, was warned against the Darwin theory and not to get involved in it. And also, at that time, the fad with young people was be read.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, you're right. I might just respond to that. I think that there are aspects, and I mentioned that in what I was just reading there, of people who simply say the only way to understand our world is through modern science and modern history. And without any God talk, without anything supernatural, I'm saying, the old pastors were right in warning those aspects. Mm-hmm. You see that?
Yeah.
I think they were right. And so I think that was good. But I think you can't give the tradition to the next generation by just simply, this is what you've got to believe.
That's right. We matured in our Christian life, mm-hmm. then it wasn't that dangerous to read evolution, and you could reason out and see how parts of that fit.
Well, I can tell you personally that when I read in our Lutheran confessions that talked about a creatio continua, that when every child is born, there is a continuing creation of God. God is continually creating that way. Then I said, it isn't just that God created everything just the way they are now, but God is continually creating. And He's active all the time. Mm-hmm. So it expanded my understanding of the whole biblical idea mm-hmm. of God's creation and blessing and continuing blessing.
I think it's quite impressive that the way the order in which the earth is created in Genesis is very scientific. I don't think the scientists disagree with the order in which things, and first God created
light
mm-hmm. and so on. And it's
separate. Yes, that happens to be a general thing. There's a correlation there. I would not deny that. On the other hand, I would not say that the days that you have there had to be 24-hour days or a long period.
I don't think scientists agree with that at all.
No, and I don't think that that was ever meant.
No.
Those days are 6 days of he was working, so that the seventh day would be set aside for that creation that he had created. Just the way humans were supposed to work and have dominion, work hard for 6 days, but on the seventh day, what? Refrain, cease from laboring. in order to praise God. And so I think that it's in that angle that I would go at. Though there is a correlation there, that's for sure. Well, listen, let's get to our passage or we won't get through. Even though we have, that's the trouble, isn't it? When you've got a little more time, you use it in talking. But anyone would like to continue talking to me, I've done that with a number of you. I'd be glad to do that as we go. Well, what about reading... I don't know your name way at the end, but I'll start way at the end even. Will you tell me your
Norma?
Name? Pardon?
Norma.
Norma. Would you read just the first verse, only one verse, to set the story here for these, the story about the sons of the gods and the giants, okay?
When men began to multiply on the face of the ground, and daughters were born to them.
Yes. Okay. First you've got not a population explosion, but just what? Men began to multiply, isn't it? And not extraordinary beauty. Not beauty queens, just what happens? Daughters are born with ordinary beauty. But when that beauty is discovered, other things happen. Now continue the next verse.
The sons of God saw that the daughters of men were fair, and they took to wife such of them as they chose.
All right. The problem isn't with the beauty. That can only be discovered. And there's always a beauty in people, isn't there? And sometimes you wonder, what does he see in her? Or the opposite. But there is a beauty there, and this is discovered. Now, here, humans, they're represented by the women in this story. By the way, I don't agree that, with some people who think this is a gender story about males against females. This is humans against God, you see that? That's what it is. And humans use what? The demigods' power. Because after all, if they have, like they considered them, ichor in their veins. See, they had special blood. Did you know, what did the gods in Mount Olympus, most of you know Greek mythology, what did they eat? They didn't eat ordinary bread. What did they eat? Ambrosia. What did they drink? They didn't drink wine the way ordinary Greeks did.
Nectar.
Pardon?
Nectar.
Nectar. And what did they have in their veins? Ichor. And so now, of course, that's a special vitality, get the idea of vital blood. And so I suppose the idea here, coming from the ancient world here, is that you not only have the beauty discovered, but it's discovered by the sons of the gods who are so powerful that they will do what they have the power to do. Can you tell me examples from the Bible where someone took a woman, raped her? This word, you remember, they took them. You remember that?
Down in the tribes of Israel, there was somebody that raped their sister, and that's why
yes.
they
mm-hmm.
took vengeance against.
Yes, that was Dinah, Jacob's, and Hamor, the prince of Shechem,
mm-hmm.
Took her. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's the word. Or you know, the most famous one is David. Saw that gal bathing inside. What was her name?
Bathsheba.
And he took her. Or in chapter 12 of Genesis, Pharaoh saw Abram's wife. She was fair, Sarah. And he took her into his harem. You see that? So here you've got it. The fact that other people would do that, boy, she's nice, isn't it? All the guys whisper that in class. And modern people like to go to bed with them, otherwise it doesn't count. Idea here is they can do it, and they do it, you see that? The sons of the gods. By the way, notice how I translated? Your translation as RSV was what?
This says
Just read it. What it says, the sons of God.
Sons of God.
Yes, notice your professor, your teacher, your leader, translates it, the sons of the gods. Look at what the difference is here. The sons of the gods, well, let's put it, here's the Hebrew word. That's the word for God, El. That's a singular, but you can also use Elohim. And that's a plural. You know, when I put a dash, that means they're equivalent, you see that, interchangeable. So, that's a plural. Just like, for instance, if you've got a seraph, that's a red angel that's around God's throne. What's the plural? Seraphs or seraphim. See that? Cherub, a blue angel, cherubs, or you can say cherubim. So for God, you can say El, or you can say Elohim. And since we're monotheists, and when it's the triune God, I learned that from my pastor, and he's right. He says, if it's the triune God, you capitalize it. If it's just any other God, you don't. You see that? You can also translate this Elohim, the second part, gods. Now, it's just my idea. The other one works out. The way your translation would be is to the angels. Do you see that? The angels who are up in God's round table in heaven, in the Oval Office, in the cabinet meeting. You know, Uriel and Gabriel and Raphael and all the rest of those people. And then there were some that were good angels and some were bad angels. Don't you know that God has two types of angels? What kind of angels does he have? He's got some in Buckingham Palace and they never get out. And they just take care of the royalty. And what are those angels called in the Bible? Archangels, or cherubim, or seraphims, or thrones, powers, dominions. But they don't go down to earth. The other messenger angels that come down to earth, they're called Melahim in Hebrew. You never know until they leave you. Many have entertained angels unaware. All of a sudden you say, oh, that was God's messenger. And usually when he leaves you. That's why I told the other class, and they all laughed, but I'll repeat it. I'll treat you with respect. I don't know how many messengers of God has sent me here in this class, so I'll treat you with more respect than I otherwise would. Because here, I think you've got, according to your translation, that some of these heavenly beings, get the idea, come down. It's similar to my idea that they're mixing up kind of the divine world, the angelic world, and the human world. I'm just a little more radical. Ordinarily, in my faith, I'm not. But in my scholarship, I am. Because, listen to the Hebrew. It says, B'nei Ha Elohim. The sons of the gods. It doesn't say B'nei Elohim, sons of God. See that? And so, I'll go to bat with anybody on that one. This is reference to an old pagan myth that the Israelites and everybody in that culture understood, that if you've got those people, divine people coming down to humans, and they beget children, they're demigods. Well, you know Hercules, don't you, the muscle man, Heracles? His father was Zeus. His mother was a human, Semele, wasn't it? And what was the result? Well, he was not just an ordinary man, he was a demigod, you see that? So he could do all kinds of things that ordinary mortals cannot do. I think that's what it's referring to. And I think the Bible, it kind of stinks the house and messes it up a little. You have to fumigate it a little. But since this is not part of the history of salvation of Israel, what they're supposed to believe, this is long before there was an Israel. It's referring to pagan people and to something that's no. I think it's a good reference. That famous Jewish scholar, Umberto Casuto, said, that's why we only have four verses. It's such an offensive story that even though they've got to tell it, they don't tell very much. They just merely refer to them. And that's about what it has. It ends. And I think that's perhaps true. Am I making sense here that the verses you read simply say that first, feminine beauty poses some possibilities that are dangerous. Especially if you've got these sons of the gods around. And then a result is that humans are no longer remaining human. So what happens in the next verse? Would you read the verse 3?
Then the Lord said, my spirit shall not abide in man forever, for he is flesh, but his days shall be 120 years.
So in other words, here comes, we had the crime, trying to be more than human, superhuman, and having children that would be superhuman like the demigods. And now comes the punishment. They'll have to be what? Their years are going to be what? Are they going to live forever? No. And we had numbers last time. Didn't we say sexagesimal is the basic unit, 60? And here you have 120 as well, 260s. Mm-hmm. So it'll be a limited time, not like we had with the patriarchs, a long time or even a longer time than limited, you see that? And he simply said, my spirit, you can translate it. Your translation is what? My spirit will no longer be strong in men, is that it? What is your translation there? Abide, yes, yes. The Adon can be translated, will no longer be strong. Look, he's flesh. You remember God breathed the breath of life and then they were alive, wasn't it? You take away the breath of life, God's spirit, then what happens? It dies. So that's it. So God will see to it that humans remain humans. El Minor in this first session referred to the fact that they thought that in Canaan, before the Israelites took it over, that there were the sons of Anak who came from the Nephilim, who came from the giants. And Joshua's good pal Caleb went down to fight in that area. But that was way in the past. Well, the story ends how then? Verse 4, would you read that also for us, please?
The Nephilim were on the earth in those days and also afterward, when the sons of God came in to the daughters of men. They bore children to them. These were the mighty men that were of old, the men of renown.
Yes, so that's in the past. So, as often in these stories, it says yes, but this is only a lost possibility for humans. God does not let humans be that way, and you don't have gigantic people like that anymore to see that. So that's kind of a crime and punishment story. Well, we don't have time to expatiate it, but I better say it so that at least you get the idea. People today sometimes want to go beyond human possibility. Do we try to live forever and make people live forever? We're going to have gene engineering and all the rest of that. And some people, Nietzsche had his great philosophy, die Wille zur Macht, the will to power. If humans only will it, they can not be the slaves that they are. They can be super men. The Nazis bought into a bit of that, and they even tried some of the racial things. Do you remember that? Taking the blue-eyed, blonde people, and actually having a beginning of the new race. And there are people who, if they had a chance to do it, would do it today. They try it at the universities, if they can get grants from the government. But it's very expensive. So this is not a story that is beyond us today. And even the government politicians, the Russians said, we sent up Sputnik, a moon made in the USSR, not made by the God of the Old Testament. And what did Nixon say? We got to the moon. And when he came back, he said, this is the greatest week in the history of the world. And as my sainted mother said, God bless her, she also went for Nixon. But she said, no, he's wrong. The greatest week in the whole history of the world is Holy Week. And she was absolutely right. But don't we say the same sort of thing? We always want to get beyond ourselves. And we get into trouble. But God is going to see to it that what? We remain human. That's, I think.
Well, you also mentioned made in the USA. Yeah. When we went on the moon.
Well, we do that too. You can hear plenty of that rhetoric. And
yeah.
That's very dangerous. You see that? Then we become more than we should be in the name of the USS USA instead of the USSR. Well, if we've gone past time, I'm sorry. But tomorrow we'll have to go through all of the deluge. So we'll really have to, we won't read all the verses.